Today is August the 29th, 2018, as we go down the final stretches of summer. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. We're also on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are a little different. It seems that when we review the installed base of operating systems for personal computing and servers, there are many conflicting claims as to the market penetration of the operating system. There are statistics and, of course, there are statistics. In the personal computing sector, the largest installed base operating system is Windows with 82.88% of the market at the end of July 2018. This is followed by the Mac OS X operating system with 12.52%, all variants of Linux distributions with a very small 1.17%, Chrome OS on the Chromebook at 0.5%, and 2.38% of other operating systems. Based on the news in the computing news media, I had figured that Linux was the leading server operating system. However, it came as a surprise to me that Windows accounts for 87% of the server market. There are three primary versions of Windows Server OS, and that's 2003, 2008, and 2012. Like Windows XP, Windows 2003 Server makes up the bulk of the market for the Windows Server. People love it and they want to keep it. Linux Server operating system trails by 12%. However, in looking carefully at the numbers, the Windows Server market is primarily installed by companies with 50 employees or less. In other words, it is a choice of small businesses. With all the noise on cloud computing, seven Linux server operating systems dominate the installed base. The leading supply is Red Hat, followed by SUSE. The other five are also RANs. They are Ubuntu, Debian, CentOS, Oracle, and Fedora. However, in reality, Red Hat and Fedora are really the same product. Red Hat is with Red Hat tech support, and Fedora, you're on your own with your in-house support. For all those who have an interest in a career in network management and tech support in the server market, I recommend you look at Windows 2003 and Fedora. I personally have had great success supporting Windows 2003. I can see why it's still dominant. The learning curve is not steep at all, and its simplicity is all a small business may need. This raises another question. Why has the Linux server market had success in large companies, but only has been a blip of presence in the personal computer platform? Linux is open source. There are literally hundreds of Linux distributions, each enabling the individual user to custom assemble their own user interface. Can you imagine a restaurant has a menu in which you can specify what ingredients are to be used and how the food is to be prepared? Each diner can specify his custom dish. The result is that there is no standard, and the wait for dinner to be served to the masses would not be practical. An example of this was when McDonald's offered a very large selection of offering on their menu. The long lines of diners standing in line, studying the huge list, resulted in lost business. This may change as Google will be implementing the use of Linux apps on the Chromebook. The Chromebook comes only in the flavor made by Google. The Chromebook may very well be the default operating system for all Linux applications. Google announced earlier this year that Linux apps would eventually be supported on Chrome OS. The feature has been available for months in the Canary and Dev channels and now works on a variety of Chromebooks from multiple manufacturers. A merge pull request on the Chromium Garrett now confirms that any device running Linux kernel 3.14 or older will never get Linux app support. For context, Linux apps on Chrome OS runs in a protected container to prevent malicious software from interfering with the main system. This container requires features only found in recent versions of the Linux kernel, like VSOC, which was added in Linux 4.8. Chromebooks usually stick with whatever kernel version they are shipped with, and many popular models are running older versions too old for containers. To get around this problem, Google has been backporting the required features to earlier kernel versions. Chrome OS developers originally hoped to bring Linux apps to every Chromebook running kernel 3.11 or newer, but now they have deemed that version's too old for the required changes. The new plan is to support everything using Linux kernel 3.15 or newer. This change means several older Chromebooks, all of which still supported by Chrome OS, will never receive Linux app support. This change means several older Chromebooks, all of which are still supported by Chrome OS, will never receive Linux app support. In a Reddit message, a number of units were identified, and it goes back as units sold or manufactured on or before February 2017, which is not that far back. So basically, if you want it to be able to run any Linux apps, it has to be a new system, and I would advise wait until it comes out, because there's no guarantee that the unit you buy is something right off an inventory shelf or it was newly placed into the supply system. As microprocessor instruction sets grew more complex, it was proposed that sequence of simpler instructions could perform the same functions faster with smaller chips. IBM developed a reduced instruction set computer. The acronym RISC was coined to mean reduced instruction set computer in 1980. But the approach was widely adopted only after the U.S. government funded university research programs and workstation vendors developed their own RISC chips. In 1991, IBM, Motorola, and Apple allied to produce the PowerPC. Inspired by the success of Berkeley's RISC project, Acorn Computers in England designed the ARM1 microprocessor in 1985. This would form the basis of the ARM architecture. An ARM processor is one of a family of CPUs based on the RISC architecture developed by Advanced RISC Machines, that's ARM, and ARM makes 32-bit and 64-bit RISC multi-core processors. ARM Holding Company is a multinational semiconductor and software design company owned by SoftBank Groups and its Vision Fund. Processors based on designs licensed from ARM or designed by licensees of one of the ARM instruction set architectures are used in all classes of computing devices. Companies that have designed chips with ARM cores included Amazon, Analog Devices, Apple, Applied Micro, Atmel, Broadcom, Cypress Semiconductors, Freescale Semiconductors, NVIDIA, Zell Linux, NXP, Qualcomm, Renesas, and Samsung. In early 2011, Qualcomm announced a new processor architecture called Krait, K-R-A-I-T, which used the ARM version 7 instruction set, but was based on Qualcomm's own processor design. It was the first Snapdragon system-on-a-chip to use Qualcomm's Adreno 320 graphics processing unit. The obvious difference, of course, was not only the number of cores. The ARM unit had octa-core chip, which is mean there was an 8-core processor, and the Snapdragon was a quad-core chip. So while the ARM processor was clocked at lower speeds than the Qualcomm processor, there's more of them. The ARM chip used the ARM Mali graphic processor, while the Snapdragon supports the Adreno GPU. In other words, what happened was that ARM says, as they extended the specs, it included hardware made by ARM, available from ARM, and it deviated from what Qualcomm did. Hey, isn't that a conflict of interest and you're trying to sell your equipment and you say you have to buy from me? British chipmaker ARM, whose mobile processor technology is used in nearly every smartphone and tablet today, unveiled a 2-year roadmap for the next generation of its chips
designed specifically for Windows PC and laptop market. They called it Windows on ARM. The first chip of ARM client CPU roadmap is the Cortex A76 CPU announced last May in Taiwan, which it claims deliver laptop-class performance while maintaining the power efficiency of a smartphone. According to its chip designer, it delivers 35% more performance than its predecessor, the A75 used in Qualcomm's current Snapdragon 845 and 850 CPUs, along with a 40% improvement in battery life. That's a big deal, 40%. A performance boost like that would make it comparable to last year's 7th generation Intel i5 chips destined for thin and light ultrabooks. So what did they announce? ARM announced a processor chip to be available in a 1 to 2 year out time frame that is comparable to an Intel processor chip, which has been on the market since last year. ARM's roadmap comparison compares its product 1 and 2 years out against Intel's current lineup. That's not the way to compare it now, come on. The first Windows 10 laptops and tablets from Samsung, Lenovo, and others powered by the Snapdragon 850 are expected to be made available just in time for the Christmas holidays. However, the follow-up to the ARM Cortex A76 is it will be delivered to ARM's partners, expected to be available for sale 2019, and it is anticipated to deliver a 15% increase in compute performance. Finally, late next year, ARM will deliver the CPU that will increase compute performance and improve power and area efficiency by 10%, according to the British computer chip designer, owned by SoftBank. ARM will have an uphill battle fighting Intel for client PCs, even if they achieve that 15% per year performance improvement. Windows on has a history of failures. Although ARM has clearly won the power efficiency battle over Intel and AMD with levels of performance per watt that are unmatched in the industry, leading to its total dominance of the mobile market, previous attempts to build Windows computers on ARM have failed. Performance with ARM's x86 emulator is a disaster, as reviews of the Snapdragon-based HP Envy X2 demonstrated. Even worse, Microsoft's emulator only supports 32-bit x86 code, even though it's running on a 64-bit ARM. So, from a performance point of view, there are questions, and it's basically useless. This makes the ARM-based PC only a little more attractive than the ill-fated Windows RT that Microsoft came out with. Back in 2011, the first Windows on ARM experiment lasted less than 2 years because only a few applications were specifically written for the Windows RT, an incompatible version of Windows 8 that ran on ARM devices. Again, last year, several manufacturers, including HP and ASUS, launched ARM-based Windows 10 laptops, this time powered by a much more powerful Qualcomm Snapdragon 835, but it ran slower than Intel's most basic x86 chip, the Celeron. Even Microsoft is giving this effort very lukewarm support since there's no plan to offer a native ARM version of Office or any other key apps. If Microsoft won't get behind it, why should any software developer make an effort? Despite the upcoming new generation of more powerful chips from ARM, the success of ARM-based Windows 10 laptop, well, it really depends on three key factors. Performance and battery life. Performance, we don't know, and it seems to be marginal, 10 to 15%. And if you have other problems and you're running at 32 bits, that's a wash. Battery life is real. Now, I've been on trips where I've gone more than just cross country where it's 6 hours, but I have an Dell 3000 running Celeron chip and it's rated for 8 hours. I get 6 hours out of it. It's fine. I don't have no problems with it. Now, if I were going to Hong Kong with over 20 hours of travel, that's a different story. And there's a question of availability of useful applications. Well, if you need the Microsoft emulator to run it, I question its performance. So this is what I recommend. Put off buying any ARM-based Windows 10 devices until the equipment has been delivered, tested, and reviewed, and it meets your requirements.
And now the Health and Wearable Technology segment by Dr. Alfred Poor. He's going to be talking about a backpack that gives you four arms. Another part is the fitness band data
predicts patient outcomes, and finally, he's going to talk about a $25 ventilator that could save babies' lives.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
You know the saying, forewarned is forearmed? Well, it's a good saying, but what if you were forearmed? I mean, like the number four. What could you do if you had two extra arms? Well, engineers and researchers at the University of Tokyo and Keio University have developed a device that answers this question. It's called the Fusion. And what it is a backpack that has two robotic arms attached to it and a camera. And the idea is that a collaborator can look over the shoulder of the person wearing the backpack and can manipulate the two robotic arms to perform tasks along with the person who's wearing it. Since it's a remote connection, they could be in the other room or they could be on the other side of the world. It's kind of cool. They use an Oculus Rift virtual reality headset so that the remote collaborator can see what's going on, and they use handheld controllers to control the movement of the robotic arms. The possibilities are intriguing. It could be a way for somebody to demonstrate a task when the other person doesn't know how to do it, just fire up the arms and show them how to do something. It also could be a way to provide an assistant to somebody who's performing a task in a limited space or a dangerous place and could hold tools or hand different pieces of hardware or whatever. It also can be a way to augment the motion of the wearer, the person who's wearing the pack, and probably could even have applications for physical therapy to guide a subject through different motions using the robotic arms. In any case, I think the really interesting thing here is that with this kind of a system, there are all kinds of possibilities that we haven't even thought of yet that could be made possible using a device like this. So this Fusion doubles your arms. What would you do with it? One of the problems doctors have is judging whether their patients are healthy enough to undergo different kinds of treatment for different diseases. This is especially a problem for cancer patients, where the chemotherapy or other kinds of therapy can put a real strain on their bodies, and they may not be physically up to the challenges that are required by these different kinds of treatment. Generally, what happens is the doctor looks at their results and tests and just sizes them up and comes up with a subjective reading of what shape they're in and whether or not they think they can do well with a given type of treatment. Well, a recent study at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles has pointed out a possible way to do this better. They did a study with cancer patients. They used standard off-the-shelf Fitbits, fitness bands, that can measure heart rate and activity levels and sleep quality and things like that. They studied 37 patients that have advanced stages of cancer and found a correlation between the amount of activity they did and how fit they were, how well prepared they were physically to undergo different kinds of treatment. They found, for example, that for every increase of 1,000 steps per day on the part of the patients, they found that there was a corresponding decrease in the number of adverse events that came as a part of the treatment. 1,000 more steps meant they were less likely to have a bad reaction to the treatment. This increased activity also showed results in terms of the patients reporting better outcomes. So this isn't necessarily an absolute way of determining what a patient can handle or can't handle, but it clearly is an opportunity to provide doctors with more objective data that can be very useful in predicting the outcomes of the cancer treatment. And I'm going to end tonight with what I call a MacGyver story. I just love this. One of the problems with underdeveloped regions is they don't have money for healthcare systems. They don't have money for hospitals and well-equipped medical centers and things like that. Out in the sparsely populated areas, they're lucky to have a trained healthcare worker at all. So I'm always interested in technology that is not only effective, but is also affordable. And I have a great one for you tonight. One of the problems with babies is sometimes they're born prematurely. And when they're born prematurely, their lungs aren't fully functioning. And so they need to be put on a ventilator to help them breathe. And the ventilator has to put air out at two different pressure levels, one for the inhaling and a lower pressure so that the body can exhale. These machines typically cost thousands and thousands of dollars, and you're not going to find them in an underdeveloped country, not out in the field. So this means that of the 15 million babies worldwide that are born prematurely, a lot of them aren't going to be able to get the breathing assistance that they need. One estimate is that there's over a million childhood deaths every year because of problems with the premature breathing. Two Western Michigan University alumni got together and created a thing that they called the NeoVent, and it's really very clever. It's a relatively simple device that can be attached to a pressurized air source, and it can then regulate the pressure. And it does this by immersing a can, a cylinder, that rides up and down on a pipe in essentially a bucket of water. And the air comes in through the pipe and bubbles out through holes at the bottom of the pipe. And there are two holes. When it bubbles out from the top hole, it causes the cylinder to rise. The air then escapes and it lowers again. And when the cylinder rises and falls, it covers the different holes. And so at one point, the air pressure is higher, and then it rises, and then the air pressure is lower. So it's kind of cool. It's very simple. Well, these two researchers have built the device, and they've actually tested it on infant mannequins, premature mannequins that are used in medical testing. They've determined that this device is very effective at producing the two levels of air pressure that are needed, and it's also not that difficult to adjust the overall air pressure or change the breathing rate for the device. And the parts cost about $25. So it's a very low cost, very effective tool. And it's the kind of clever invention that I think is wonderful because it has the potential of saving millions and millions of lives over the years.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. From the Tech Corner, Joe and I will be talking about what's happening with smartphone technologies. One of the major things that most people may not be aware of is what's the difference between CDMA and GSM, and is confusion in the marketplace, and where is that Android Pie documentation? If you're shopping for a mobile phone, you're probably in for a lot of acronyms that you may or may not be familiar with. Well, let's get back to a little basic, and here's what you need to know. There are two basic technologies in mobile phones, CDMA and GSM, and they represent a gap that, well, they're the reason you can't use many AT&T phones on Verizon's network and vice versa. Well, what does CDMA versus GSM really mean for you? CDMA means Code Division Multiple Access, and GSM stands for Global System for Mobiles, or shorthand for two major radio systems used in cell phones. Both acronyms tend to group together a bunch of technologies run by the same entities. Which carriers are CDMA and which are GSM? In the United States, Sprint, Verizon, and U.S. Cellular uses CDMA. AT&T, T-Mobile uses GSM. Most of the world, by the way, uses GSM. The global spread of GSM came about because in 1987, Europe mandated the technology by law, and because GSA comes from an industry consortium, what we now call CDMA, by and large is owned by chipmaker Qualcomm. This made it less expensive for third parties to build GSM equipment. There are several variants and options carriers can choose. We'll focus on U.S. networks. For core quality, the technology you use is much less important than the way your carrier has built its network. There are good and bad CDMA and good and bad GSMA networks. But there are key differences between the technologies. Here's what you need to know as a consumer. It's much easier to swap phones on GSM networks because GSM carriers put customer information on a removable SIM card. Take the card out, put in a different phone, and the new phone now has your number. What's more, to be considered GSM, a carrier must accept any GSM-compliant phone, so the GSM carriers don't have total control of the phone that you're using. However, that's not the case with CDMA. In the United States, CDMA carriers use network-based whitelists to verify their subscribers. That means you can only switch phones with your carrier's permission
and the carrier doesn't have to accept any particular phone onto its network. It could, and typically, U.S. carriers choose not to. Many Sprint and Verizon phones now have SIM cards, but that isn't because of CDMA. The SIM cards are there for Sprint's and Verizon's 4G LTE networks, because the LTE standard also uses SIM cards. The phones may also have SIM slots to support foreign GSMA networks as world phones. So why did so many U.S. carriers go with CDMA? When Verizon's predecessors and Sprint switched from analog to digital in 1995 and 1996, CDMA was the newest, hottest, fastest technology. It offered more capacity, better call quality, and more potential than GSM of the day. GSM caught up, by the way, so now the carriers are pretty much on par with each other. It's possible to switch from CDMA to GSM. Bell and Telus in Canada have done it, to get access to a wider variety of off-the-shelf GSMA phones. But Verizon and Sprint are big enough that they can demand custom phones built for them, so they don't see the need to waste money switching 3G technologies when they could be building out to their 4G networks. CDMA and GSM are both multiple access technologies. There's ways for people to cram multiple phone calls or internet connections onto one radio channel. GSM came first. It's a time division system. Calls take turns. Your voice is transformed into digital data, which is given a channel and a time slot. So three calls on one channel look like this. 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. On the other end, the receiver only listens to the assigned time slot and pieces the call back together. The pulsing of time division signal creates a notorious GSM buzz, a buzzing sound whenever you put a GSM phone near a speaker. That's mostly gone now because 3G GMSA isn't a time division technology. CDMA required a bit more processing power. It's a code division system. Every call's data is encoded with a unique key. Then the calls are all transmitted at once. So if you have calls 1, 2, 3 in a channel, the channel would just say 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, and so on. The receivers each have the unique key to divide the combined signals into its individual calls. Code division turns out to be more powerful and flexible technology, so 3G GSM is actually a CDMA technology called WCDMA, or wideband CDMA. Wideband CDMA requires wider channels than older CDMA systems, as the name implies, but it has more data capacity. Since its inception, GSM has evolved faster than CDMA, and wide-channel CDMA is considered a 3G version of GSM technology. CDMA networks, meanwhile, are stuck at 3.6 megabits per second. While faster CDMA technologies exist, U.S. carriers chose not to install them and instead turned to 4G LTE for more compatible with global standards. LTE, or long-term evolution, is a globally accepted 4G wireless standard. That should make everyone compatible, right? Wrong. While most phones starting in 2017 sold use LTE for data, Sprint phone still uses CDMA for all voice calls, and Verizon still has a network-based whitelist for phones that will work on the network. You can try to wriggle around the whitelist as ZTE did with their Axon 7 phone, but the process itself is not very reliable. In June of this year, Verizon introduced its first two LTE-only phones. This is part of a move to an all-LTE system. Verizon says it wants to shut down CDMA by 2019. Without CDMA, it's going to become easier for AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon devices to be compatible in the future, but that still leaves Sprint out. Also, the four carriers are using LTE in different frequency bands, with some of their phones spec to exclude the other carriers' bands, making it harder to switch carriers. Sprint, once again, is the odd one out here because it runs on an unusual frequency band, which is band 41. A few phones support all four carriers by combining CDMA, GSM, and LTE. The iPhone 6 and later, the Motorola G4 and later, the Samsung Galaxy S7 and later, the Nexus 6 and later, the Google Pixel phones, and the Moto E4 all work across all four carriers. Other manufacturers' unlocked devices generally don't include CDMA radios because they don't see a big market in unlocked phones being used on Sprint and Verizon. So what does it all mean for you? If you want to switch phones often, use your phone in Europe, or use imported phones, just go with AT&T, T-Mobile, or virtual carriers on those networks. Otherwise, pick your carrier based on coverage and call quality in your area, and assume you probably need a new phone and need to switch carriers.
Joe, you have had many smartphones.
Can you lend us some of your insights that you've gained with all the different smartphone models, as well as the progression of Android operating systems? I know you are considering the acquisition of another cell phone.
Hank, you know, I've never been happy with a smartphone. I had the Samsung Note 4, I think it was, and it was very good at what it did, and what it didn't do was fine. But ever so often, something would happen within the operating system, and I was told, that's not a bug, that's a feature. And every time it was a feature, I didn't know it was there, I didn't like it, I didn't want it. Then I got after that a Samsung S7, I think it was. And then after that, I got something else. And last year, I got a thing called the Pixel. That was a year and a half ago. And the Pixel was made by or contracted for by Google. And the important thing for the Pixel was that since it was a Google product, it was the first ones to get the Google update. And Google was coming out with all kinds of updates left and right. Well, it seems that last week, Google decided that Android Pie was going to be the update of the day, and they updated my Pixel, and I got to tell you, it was fantastic. They changed a lot of the interfaces, they got rid of a lot of the problems. There was just one minor problem with it. I don't understand it. I had learned Android, but now Android had changed. Now, I don't expect that these things would never change. I know that they change. They change to fix it. They change to improve it. You know, one of the really great things about Google's Android is when they change things, they document it so thoroughly that you can't get confused. What's that? You didn't know that? Oh, sure, Hank. The only problem is they keep mark the documentation top secret, lock it in the corporate vault out in California someplace, and nobody is ever allowed to see that documentation. Well, maybe I'm over-exaggerating. Maybe somebody is allowed to see it, but when I asked for it, I didn't even get an answer. Now, this is the problem. If you're not going to provide documentation, and you are going to make a change that's automatic and that is thorough, who's going to know you made the change? Well, eventually you'll have to use one of those new techniques and one of those new features, and at that point, you'll know that a change came. For example, in Pi, Android Pi, if a phone call comes in while you're on another application, a little window opens up with the first letter or the picture of the person who's calling and an ability for you to click and change over or an ability for you to ignore it and let it go to voicemail. That's a very good feature. People would like to know about that. But again, how would they find out? By accident. That is the silliest marketing I have ever heard of from anybody. When I was cursing about it the other day, Joanna said to me, well, why don't you just switch over and get an iPhone? And she's been saying that to me every time I curse about everything that smartphones do that are wrong. But what she forgets is that everybody, not somebody, but everybody is unhappy with everybody's phone when they find that it can't do something that they want it to do or it's hidden. Marketing used to be about how to sell a product. Today it seems to be about how to fool people into buying your product. I don't know that there's any real way around this. I did download somebody else's attempt to write a manual on Android, but unfortunately I forgot the name of the manual, and I can't find it on my phone. It's very confused. Everything is very confused. I'm very confused.
Hey, Joe, you know what RTFM means, right? Read the fine manual. Google is renowned for the completeness and organization of their user's guide. Tell us more.
Maybe you haven't gotten your copy of Android Pie. That's 9 in the series. And so you're wondering what's upcoming and what's going to be in it. How do you use the new gesture features and all sorts of things like that. So it would be logical for you to perhaps go to Google and search on Android Pie new features, Android Pie manual, Android Pie how to use, something like that. Well, I did that, and I found I could click on an article that said 5 best features of Android Pie. Another one said 10 best features of Android Pie. Another one said 14 best features of Android Pie. I mean, come on, guys, give me a break. If anybody happens to know anybody at Google, why don't you ask them how come they don't simply release a manual, tech manual, a consumer manual, a programming manual, any kind of a manual. I mean, come on, Google, give me a manual. End the confusion, end my pain, please. At any rate, there are a couple of new features in Android Pie that are really worthwhile. They have a new battery-saving feature which modifies or adjusts the brightness. They have something else in that. I'm not sure what it is, but my battery now runs out at almost twice the speed it used to under Android 8. But that's another problem we'll talk about some other night. They have gestures. What is a gesture? Well, it's the way you hold and move the phone instead of dictating in a change or a command or typing a command. You move the phone around. I hope that your arm is not something that moves by itself. You know, some people have a problem with that, and that pretty much screws up the whole idea of gestures. There's other good positive things in it. I think there are so many good things in my Pixel that in January, when I finally finished paying for it, I might trade it in on an iPhone.
By the way, Joe, I've been referring to Android.com for the Android System Development Kit. The SDK, which is the System Development Kit, is replete with comprehensive documentation, albeit in technical terms. Those early radar setups with spinning dish antennas would send out a microwave ping and time and how long it took before its echo bounced back from an object in its path. It used the time of flight of that ping to determine distance. The first sonar used the time of flight of sound underwater to determine the distance that its echo traveled. LiDAR does the same thing with light from a laser, or sometimes an LED, measuring distance between the time a pulse of light begins and when a photo detector sees it reflecting from an object. The amazing thing is that you can buy any of these flight sensors for less than $10. Marty, tell us more.
What, flies in a cybernetic house? Oops, that comma doesn't belong there. What flies in a cybernetic house? Okay, time flies, but measuring how long it takes other things to fly is one of the ways we get the house to come to its senses, or more accurately, it's one of the ways we add senses to the house. Confused yet? Don't worry. If you haven't yet figured out my opening puns, I'll soon unravel them, but let's start with some things you may know a little bit about. Radar blips are microwave pulses that echo back when they bounce off something, and you know how far away that something is by measuring their round-trip time. The distance part of radar works by measuring the time of flight of radio waves, usually microwave, because the higher the frequency, the higher the resolution of the radar beams. You've heard of radar, and you know there are different kinds and different ways it can work, but this basic time of flight underpinning of the technology is the only part I want to get into right now. You may have heard of sonar, where a pulse of sound is sent through water, and the system listens for its echo when it bounces off of something. In the case of sonar, that distance measurement involves the time of flight of sound through water. If the time of flight seems strange for water, you can either think of it as the time of swim, or just accept the convention and think of a speed of sound manta ray flying underwater. Time of flight of sound in water. Am I hearing some of you tell me that sonar also works in the air? Well, it does. And not many people are deep geek enough to know that the proper term for that is sodar, with a D instead of an N. It's the proper term for measuring distance by measuring the time of flight of an audio blip through air. Sodar. Now, do I care? Do you care? I just don't want anybody to be confused by that. The same technique is also used to take measurements inside solids or liquids. It's also part of the makeup of the ultrasound imagers that, for example, let you see the developing baby while still inside mommy. Sonograms, sonography, and more industrial forms of ultrasonic imaging are all kissing cousins in this realm. Then there's the darling of the self-driving cars, LIDAR, the laser version of radar, which measures the time of flight of a blip of light between when the pulse goes out and when the companion photo detector senses it. Somewhere between math class and physics class, you learned the classic formula, RT equals D. RT equals D stands for rate times time equals distance. That's as complicated as you need to be to understand how these time of flight sensors work. R, the rate, is either the speed of light for radar or LIDAR, or the speed of sound through the air for sonar, the speed of sound through water for sonar, the speed of sound through amniotic fluid for fetus peaks, and so on. Let's stay that simple. We're talking about a cybernetic house. I'm double-checking the designs, and so far I'm not seeing any gravitational wells, no deep-sea fluid pressures, no stratospheric thinning of the air. And isn't it nice for a change for the math to be this easy? Multiply the rate R times half the time of flight, because it's a round trip and we only need half, to know the distance. In fact, the math is so easy that just about everything a cybernetic house needs to know is delivered directly by the microcircuit with the sensor on it or in it. But there's another principle at work here. Precision is relative. Got that? Precision is relative. Maybe not my relatives or your relatives, but relative. Or to put it another way, sometimes sloppy numbers are precise enough. Let me offer some examples. Think about pulling your car into the garage. Let's say you can put a sensor on the back wall of the garage that tells you the distance from that back wall to the first object it detects. If your car isn't there, the first object may be beyond the sensor's range, and that's meaningful because it could mean that the garage door is open. If the distance it measures is the distance to the garage door, fine. Either the garage door is closed or the front of the car is positioned exactly where the inside of the garage door usually goes. If the distance is farther than the garage door but not out of range, that could mean the car is in the driveway outside the garage. Once the car is inside the garage, a distance measurement can trigger some kind of easy, almost, whoa, signal to the driver. How accurate should those measurements be? Well, think about it. You can be off by 3 to 6 inches and probably be okay if your garage isn't too tight front to back. If the total measurement range is, oh, say, 50 feet, 3 to 6 inches represents an accuracy of 0.5% to 1%. That's about 1,000 times less precise than most of the sensors you might use. May I be coarse, well, mathematically coarse, that is. A sensor on the ceiling 9 to 10 feet above the floor of the garage is only ever likely to see one of three targets, either the garage door if it's open and right under the sensor, or the top of the vehicle if it's in the garage, or the garage floor. Think about it. You're looking down from the ceiling. You're going to see the garage door. If it's open, you're going to see the top of a vehicle if there's one in place, or you're going to see the distance to the floor. Those measurements can be off as much as 1 to 2 feet and still give a controller good information. Vehicles in or around the garage represent one area where time of flight sensors can be useful. Also, vehicles near the front door and vehicles near the apron of the driveway. By the way, for those of you who want to fiddle around with time-of-flight sensors, there are lots of breakout boards available for less than $20 and a good number under 10. You can browse the Adafruit or Pololu sites, for example, and use the search term distance. Adafruit is A-D-A fruit, A-D-A-F-R-U-I-T. Pololu is Polo-L-U, P-O-L-O-L-U. Be very careful. If there's the least bit of electronic experimenter in you, these sites have goodies, well, for me anyway, goodies that seem to invite addiction. There's one other application we're thinking about for cheap and simple radar sensors. It has to do with knowing whether rooms are occupied or vacant, in part so that if there's an emergency, the house can give first responders a good idea of where they're most needed. Now, since I don't allow indoor cameras, those are out. Even the thermal mapping isn't allowed in a few specific places, specifically bathrooms. Small radar heads under the flooring are one way to see if there's anything above, assuming we choose an operating frequency that can see through the flooring but not through people. If that doesn't work, we may have to try something else. We'll have so much time of flight sensing going on that the house should offer reward miles. Here's something that may surprise you. Your phone probably has time-of-flight sensor optics to accomplish gesture recognition, or maybe your camera to help with autofocus. Many robot vacuum cleaners use LiDAR sensors. Radar or sonar could well be in your car if you have rear or side obstacle detectors or warning systems. I should probably talk about longevity, since one of the goals for our cybernetic house design is to go 40 years without needing major maintenance, repairs, or replacements. How good are today's time-of-flight sensors at these things? In a way, that's like asking, how many years will your car last? Or how long will it be before you hit 100,000 miles? It all depends on how hard you drive it. More on that in a second. But there are some native longevity challenges with some of these technologies. Well, one of them, sonar. It has to do with the part that sends that sound blip into the air or the water. It's a piezoelectric transducer, meaning when you apply a voltage to it, it flexes. Piezo elements, especially in the inexpensive sensors that I'm talking about, are built with crystals or a crystalline ceramic on a thin metal wafer. Over time, and as I said, with more usage, and as I haven't said yet, with continued exposure to the environment, the crystalline infrastructure will fracture and stop working. I won't be using sonar, but it might work out for what you design, and it's really cheap to try out. I mentioned usage, how hard you drive these things, and it's a bit of a revelation to appreciate that you don't have to drive them continuously. If you have a radar or LiDAR on the back wall of the garage or on the ceiling, it can pretty much idle at 2 to 10 samples per second. That's a duty cycle of less than 5% at worst, meaning it takes 20 times longer to reach the sensor's life expectancy. In an environment with even more sensors, it gets easy to develop logic that determines when it's okay to get even more relaxed, or to identify those rare moments when it might be smart to take more frequent measurements. Time-of-flight sensors are interesting, but they're not new. The very first measurement of the speed of sound was made in, you want to guess? 1640, even before Hank was born. It used the swings of a pendulum to measure the time it took for the sound of a cannon several miles away to arrive. The old practice of dropping a pebble down a dark hole and measuring how long before you heard it hit was more lore than science. Remember, in those days, it was hard to include gravitational acceleration in calculations. Radar is where the technology really advanced. It was wartime and lives were at stake that radar might help protect. The spinning radar dishes you still see in places like some airport control towers originated as a way to spin that time of flight distance measurement while synchronizing the spin of elements in a cathode ray tube display and using the time of flight to determine how far from center a blip would appear. Hey, we're talking about motors and vacuum tubes and the technology of World War II. So the inventors who figured out how to cobble up working radar systems out of that stuff, well, they deserve continuing credit for their cleverness. Now, we're just trying to keep the car from going too deeply into the garage, and even that has a simple solution, one you hear from Hank all the time. Just back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty.
Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, September the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bardo Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club General Meeting is Thursday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have their meeting on Friday, September the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Harry J. Scherer Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting Tuesday, September the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Community Room in Princeton Public Library, 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need some technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. Just remember, there is no such thing as a dumb question. And I have the following advice for computer club announcements. All the relevant information should be on the same page, preferably on the home page. And the computer club announcement should have the following: the name of the club, topic of presentation, if any, day of week, and the date of meeting and time, the venue of the meeting, and the location of the venue. Hey, we'll be seeing you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or wbai.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do: back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.